Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome back to Defrag. Alright, so we got a lot of questions this week, and one false start, but we're back on track, and here we go. So, first question of the day is from Syadmi, and it says, as for memory cleaners, which we talked about this last week, it says, how about Memory Booster from Rhizomesoft? They claim it's a call to clear process working set, not a dump to page file. So would that give you any benefit over the ones that we talked about last week?
Well, I mean, it will make it as if your processes have a smaller working set for a brief period of time until they have requested, hey, actually, I did need this, you know, page this thing back in.
Yeah.
Or, you know, increase my working set. A lot of applications will assume they have a particular working set. People would use this software to say, I'm going to simulate as if my machine has a higher memory pressure than currently exists in order to reduce the working set of those processes. But again, it's kind of like, unless you are hitting a problem, why would you bother using it,
yeah.
Right? Like, your RAM is there to be used. It's not there to be empty.
Can you think of any situation where you would install something like that?
No.
All right.
I've never, ever needed to install anything like that before.
I have needed to do like a RAM extender, but that was 15 years ago.
A virtual RAM drive?
Yeah. So there were times back in the day for some pretty heavy, you know, high-test things that we were doing that we had to use something like that. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of anything in modern times that would cause me to install something like that. So
no, the Windows Virtual Memory Manager is really, really tuned. I mean, it has gone through years and years of performance testing to work under the widest variety of scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And it will, you know, juggle things based on the load that it's taking on. You know, it's why that we can build with the same kernel, a client, a server, Azure. You know, we scale up to data center levels. We scale down all the way to tablets. You know, that the memory manager is efficient in many, many, many different scenarios.
Yeah.
It's basically best not to touch it.
Yeah. If it's not broke, don't try to fix it. All right. Next question from Rod Falanga. He says, hi, and I love your show. We've been experiencing some odd problems for the last month or so. We'll be using our computers, both desktop and laptops, and then suddenly we lose internet connectivity. We're using Windows 7. For example, this happened to me today. I was doing some online training, watching videos, and it was fine. After a couple hours, I decided to stop and take a break. At this point, I lost internet connectivity to everything. I couldn't reach any of the other devices on my home network. I couldn't get to the router, which I'm directly connected. I checked the event log, but I couldn't see anything obvious. I bring up PowerShell, and I did an IP config, see the attached. I do see something there. It says media disconnected, but I don't know if that has any bearing on my problem or not. I've rebooted my PC, which didn't help, and I've cycled power on my router. It didn't help. I powered my PC down and left it off for 10 minutes. I'm online now, but frankly, I don't trust it. This behavior has affected my wife's machine as well, which is on the same network over the last month or so. And I've been in contact with CenturyLink, my DSL provider, and they claim there's no problem. Any ideas?
Well, if you're losing contact within your own network, you know, to your other various devices, it can actually be a number of different issues. First thing I would try is we have, you know, the troubleshooter in the network control panel. Troubleshoot your problems, see what it comes up with. It can range anywhere from having bad drivers for your NIC. It can range on if you're actually physically connected to the router via the cable. It can have some bad cables.
Yeah.
The router might need a firmware update. You could be sending a lot of packets through at a particular time, and then that overwhelms your router, and your router's kind of stuck.
Yeah.
As for, you know, shutting down your machine and turning it back on again, it could actually be physically hardware related with your machine.
Mm-hmm. So if it's hardware related to his machine, what about his wife's machine?
Are they the same hardware? One thing that I've noticed when you're connected physically to a router that can affect your LAN is check the flow control that is set on your NIC. You can disable flow control. It'll make things significantly slower, but actually see if it makes any difference.
Yeah.
Set your auto negotiation to be you know, if you're connected to a 10, 100 gigabit link, set it to, you know, either 10 or 100 or gigabit. Don't do auto negotiation. Set it up so that it will always connect at a particular speed, see if it makes any kind of difference.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately for this kind of thing, we would need trace logs.
Yeah. And this sounds to me, I mean, I hate to say it, but I've had some routers who have gone south on me quickly. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what it is about routers that I don't have much hardware that goes bad.
Mm-hmm.
But routers seem to have a lifespan. So the first thing I would try is just try a different router, if you can get your hands on one.
Yeah, we can get your hands on a
different
router.
And see if you still have the same problems. That's going to at least eliminate the router as the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But
who knows? You could actually be being attacked from the outside through CenturyLink or through your ISP, and your router's getting hit with malformed packets, and it's, you know, getting screwy.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple things that you can try there, but I'd try a new router just to see if that takes care of it. Mm-hmm. I had a really, you know, high-end router, and I thought, it can't be bad, but it had gone bad within about 8 months of getting it. So, that's one thing to take a look at there. All right, next question from our own Nick Fillingham of Microsoft. He says, I'm thinking of building a 10-terabyte array with 6 2-terabyte drives and RAID 5 so that they have redundancy in case one fails. Thoughts on RAID 5 versus JVOD versus RAID 6 versus other RAID types? And can you recommend a RAID controller card that supports 6 or 8 drives? A previous card that you had recommended to Nick only supports 4 drives. And any concern with setting up a 6x2-terabyte RAID 5? Is there a better solution for building like a 10-terabyte redundant array?
These kind of questions are all about, you know, how are you going to use the array?
Yeah.
And I think he'd stated that it was just, you know,
media server. Yeah,
media
just something for the house.
Right.
Home server.
So RAID 5 is perfectly acceptable. You know, JVOD is okay, but you don't get the redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
So I generally stay away from that.
Yeah.
RAID 5 is great. It has great throughput. Read access is wonderful on it. It's perfectly acceptable for a home scenario. The card that I recommended was an LSI, I think, 9240i.
Mm-hmm.
So the step up to that is the 9280 or 9260i. I can't remember. It's the difference between two ports that'll handle 4 drives in a SAS configuration or single ports that only, or two ports that handle the 8 drives.
Yeah.
So this is a great card. I use it. It's expensive, you know, but it's definitely, definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a similar configuration with some Hitachi drives, and, you know, I'm getting over 400 megabit per second.
Yeah.
If you do the WinSat disk enumeration, no, test, the WinSat test for disk, you can get some really good perf comparisons between different RAID configurations.
Do you have a favorite hard drive you like, favorite brand?
Samsung, Hitachi. I had really good luck with the Samsung spin points.
Yeah. It's funny because I was talking to someone the other day, and we were talking about how people usually have a brand of hard drive they like, and it's usually decided by what other hard drives have failed in their past.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've had like a Toshiba or a Seagate drive that's failed, and you're like, oh, I'll never buy another one of those. But really, all drives, you know, have their problems.
All drives will have their failures. I had really good luck with the Samsung spin point because they're quiet.
Yeah.
Historically, Seagates have been a little bit louder.
Yeah.
But again, it all really depends on what line it is that they are producing. If you keep going on, oh, I had experience 5 years ago with a drive that failed, it's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
I've had experiences with drive failures with every manufacturer
yeah.
out there.
Sooner or later, you got nothing left to choose from.
Exactly. You know,
yeah.
you kind of go with, well, today, what am I looking for? I'm looking for perf, I'm looking for price.
Size yeah.
and how loud they are,
mm-hmm.
right? They're all going to fail at some point.
Yeah.
You know, you read the MTBF, the meantime before failure, and it's like, oh, it's 1,000,000 hours or something. It's like, no, not really. That's theoretical.
Best case scenario.
Always plan for the disaster case. When I buy drives, so when I bought my the first 4 drive array, I bought it with a fifth drive that I've not used yet, because I know one of those drives are going to fail. It doesn't matter to me that one of them are going to fail. I preemptively decided one of them is at least going to fail, so I got another drive. Same series. Is it going unused?
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you get them in bulk, you get a little bit cheaper. So every time I buy drives, I'll get an extra one, because I know it's going to fail. Why would you rely as that being your sole drive?
Yeah.
You know?
I like Western Digital drives, just as a personal preference.
Western Digital greens and blacks are great drives.
It's so hard to find ones. I don't want a green drive, though. I've read a lot of problems with, because the green drives do something, they, you know, write smaller packet. I don't know what the heck they're doing. But they said don't use them in a RAID, because the life of them won't be as long.
Okay.
So it's getting increasingly hard not to find, you know, WD green drives.
Well, remember, consumer drives aren't designed for RAID.
Yeah.
Right? Like, when anyone is thinking about RAID, it's, you know, data centers, enterprise, and drives that have been specifically tested, specifically certified for RAID are really, really expensive.
Yeah, I have a family member who only buys enterprise drives. What's the difference between an enterprise drive and a normal drive? Testing
and quality, right? Like, the parts are essentially identical.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when Intel produces chips, right? It's not that, oh, they're specifically making 2.2 gigahertz versus 2.4 gigahertz chips. It's, no, they made 2.4 gigahertz and it didn't live up to the testing, and they marked it down to 2.2. So what it is, that's just the way it is. They get binned in a particular manner.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next question.
We defragged a bunch of third parties today.
Yeah. All right. And we have a bunch of questions here, too, from internal. This is from our own Michael O'Neill, who used to run the studio here. It says, how do I make my favorite sync with all my PCs? I know he's got a couple of new machines, so he's probably thinking about that now.
Easiest way, I'm going to give two methods. Live mesh. Simplest way right now to do syncing of favorites, and not just favorites, any folders that you want across your different machines. Favorites are nice because they're just links.
Yeah.
You know, and anytime you're doing syncing across machines and you're using the cloud to do it, don't try to do it with multi-megabyte files. It's just going to take longer to try to sync.
Mm-hmm.
But Live Mesh is great. Dropbox is great.
Yeah.
I will use either or depending on what I feel like, whatever the mood strikes. I've got machines set up for both occasionally. Mm-hmm. I like Dropbox for a lot of reasons. You know, you can give other people rights to it. So if I'm syncing different types of stuff, you know, the stuff just for me that I want, I might just use Live Mesh for it. And if I know, hey, we're doing, you know, shared collaboration, the other person might be using their phone primarily to do it. You know, they're on a different type of phone, but I know they have Dropbox. I might use Dropbox in order to share that stuff out.
Yeah.
So lots of different options, but those are definitely your easiest.
Okay, cool. Awesome. All right, and this was a question for me. I had my inbox up on one side of my screen, and I had Windows Explorer up on the other side of the screen. I was going between the two,
mm-hmm.
and I went to Shift-Delete an email
mm-hmm.
In Outlook, and it turns out that I actually had something selected on the right in Windows Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
So I shift-deleted a file, and mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what file it was that I just shift-deleted.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote you, and I was like, hey, Gov, is there any way from like a log or something just to see what the name of the file was that I just deleted? And your answer to that was?
No.
No.
We don't log all file deletions. It would be very expensive to log that. But there are tons of undelete utilities out there. If you really cared about it, you would do that. If you are constantly doing the, or you might be getting into this kind of situation where you're always shift deleting something off the desktop.
Yeah.
You could, you know, as a method of protecting yourself, you could remove delete rights from things that are on your desktop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you might protect yourself that way.
Yeah.
You could set up auditing on files on the desktop folder, and then you could go and check through auditing what file it was that got deleted or that got changed on your desktop if you wanted to, not necessarily take away your delete rights.
I figure if it was important, I'd remember what it was, and I can always go to a backup if I have to, so I'm keeping an eye on that backup in case, you know, I
mean, ultimately, you should probably just stay away from shift deleting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been bitten by it by a number of times myself, so I can say that I have experience in screwing myself over. So I've just learned to not shift-delete. I'll just delete.
Well, you know, if it's on my desktop, if it's something that's on my computer, I typically wouldn't shift-delete.
Mm.
But because you only have, you know, a finite amount of space in Outlook,
mm-hmm.
and I'm quickly approaching that amount of space, I tend to shift-delete every email I get the opportunity to.
Mm.
So that's where I get into that habit. But it is a bad habit, so I'm going to try to curb myself off that.
You know, one method of doing it is that you can auto-archive your deleted items
yeah.
to a PST every day.
Yeah.
That way you can safely just delete it, and you're not taking up your Exchange server space.
Yeah, that's true. I should do that. All right, next question from Ryan Gower. It says, I've written a VB script that's supposed to copy files from a network location, rename them to have a JPEG extension, resize them in Photoshop, and save them to a different folder. If I double-click on the script, it executes perfectly. However, I'm currently banging my head against the wall trying to get the script to run via the task scheduler. I wrapped the script in a batch file to redirect the output to a file, and I got this message. Microsoft VB runtime error, ActiveX component can't create object, Photoshop.application. The same behavior occurs if I'm running it on my local Windows 7 Pro 64-bit machine, fully updated, or on one of our Windows Server 2008 R2 fully updated machines. I've attached a code to the script as well as the export task, the debug file, and the batch file for your perusal. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Keep up the great work.
So I took a look at this one, you know, looked at the script, looked at exactly what he was doing, and it actually turned out to be a relatively simple problem. In that task scheduler by default will try to run the script as system.
Mm-hmm.
When it runs it as system, it runs it in session 0. Session 0 doesn't have a UI. Also related to that is the application isn't installed for the system user. It was never designed to ever be run as system.
Yeah.
And you know, when you break down this problem, it's like, okay, so he's copying pictures and then he's resizing it using Photoshop. Photoshop
is a lot of tool.
Yeah, you're resizing a square using a, you know, Titanic.
Yeah, it's like hammering a nail with a
tornado
sledgehammer. Yeah,
I mean, you're destroying a fly with a supernova. Let's expand the hyperbole here.
Yeah.
Anyways, beyond trying to do this, you know, in a fast kind of sense, like the way that the script was written was like copy a picture, then resize, a picture, then resize. So you're constantly instantiating Photoshop over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Massive perf hit in trying to do this. So, you know, looking at the problem, we say, well, what do you want to do? You want to copy files, you want to resize the pictures. You want to be able to do that without a user logged into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, background task. What is a simple way of doing it? There's a lot of different scripts out there that you can do. There's .NET, there's PowerShell that you can use. .NET
use some for our magic folder for publishing these videos.
There you go.
Picture, screenshot.
So there's lots of little tools that are specifically designed for resizing pictures. And that's where we kind of ended up. I pointed him to a third party, Image Magic. They have a lot of scripting tools for this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a ready-made program that you can just pass command line args to if you don't want to do a lot of coding yourself.
Yeah.
There's .NET assemblies that you can use that, you know, you can do a lot more customization with it for resizing pictures. If you want to wrap that in a PowerShell script, make it really easy to update. Though we actually ended up using those methods in the end, and that worked out really, really well for this particular customer.
Cool.
And yeah, definitely for something like that, you know, you really want to break down what it is that you're trying to do and see if you're using the right tools to actually accomplish it.
Okay, excellent. All right, next question here. Let's see, it says, I use a custom keyboard, pop-up keyboard on my tablet PC. Is there a way to disable the tablet PC input panel on Windows 7? And yeah, there's a MSDN article on this that we can link to. But also, you can do it right from the options. So, if you bring this up,
the tablet PC input panel.
Yeah, and so this is a little different from a on-screen keyboard that you typically might see. And you usually only see this if you have a tablet PC.
Right.
But right here under the opening tab, there's several checkboxes that you can uncheck. So, use the input panel tab, it's one of them. And show the icon on the taskbar. You probably don't want that. And, so you can take all those checkboxes off. And that should take care of your problem, get rid of that so you can use your custom one.
There you go.
All right. Next question. Without the funds to buy an SSD for my soon-to-arrive laptop and the knowledge that Visual Studio 2010 can be quite slow at times on normal hard disk, I was trying to come up with a possible solution to improve performance. The laptop will have a 5400 RPM drive and 8 gig of RAM. ReadyBoost was one option I was looking at on the laptop. It has an SD card slot, which we talked about that may or may not work. So leaving a large card in there and allocating it to ReadyBoost. However, on the machine will have 8 gig of RAM, and I'm not certain ReadyBoost would do that much good, being that there's plenty of RAM left on the disk cache. Then I remembered on old netbooks, which use SD cards as their main storage, and wondered whether I could just install Visual Studio on the SD card or move it and mount the SD card into program files. Would that likely give me better performance than loading from the hard drive, kind of like a poor man's hybrid drive? Is this likely to work? Will it give any benefit, cause any problems, work better than a USB drive instead of SD? What do you think?
Depends on the SD card. It depends on your bus and how fast it's actually being
accessed. Depends on the reader.
Really depends on the reader. Most SD cards are designed for photography. Like, that is their biggest use case. So whenever you see something like a Class 6 or a Class 10 drive, I think they're up to now, how they bench their performance is they're by sequential writes.
Yeah.
So that's their fastest speed. It's sequential writes, sequential reads. That may or may not be how, Visual Studio is going to be used off of this SD card.
Yeah.
You could do, interesting things like using Subst to mount the drive into a particular folder and install Visual Studio to that. It may or may not work.
Yeah.
You would actually have to test that out to see if you had better performance.
You should probably do a performance test just to see how fast is that going to be to begin with, and see what that is compared to your
Regular
drive.
Yep.
So hard to say there, but you test out speed, and of course, ReadyBoost may or may not work.
Well, I mean, ReadyBoost will work. It will hit the ReadyBoost drive before it will hit your hard drive, which will help. Is just how much, what is the percentage gain that you can get out of it. So yes, you may or may not visually see or perceive an improvement, but there will be a percentage improvement. Honestly, on this particular drive, you might actually just want to replace the entire system drive with an SSD, as opposed to keeping with a 5400 RPM drive.
Okay, there you have it. So next one, it says, I downloaded a video that's 11 parts the other day. Today I tried to extract it, but it tells me that part 4 is corrupt, so I checked Keep Broken Files, but of course it only gave me the beginning of the video. So I wonder if it's possible to extract it starting at part 5. And if that can't be done, does anyone know a good way to possibly fix a corrupt archive? Thank you. Note, I re-downloaded part 4 and it still doesn't work. It's the right size too, so I know there are no downloading errors. What are your thoughts on this? I've seen this before. I mean, you have a RAR archive that's split into, 10, 20, however many different pieces. You've got a video file that's in there. So one of them's corrupt, and you have no method to get to replace that file. Ideally, if you had parity files, then, that would help you repair that. But in this case, I'm assuming that there are not parity files available for it.
Right.
So, Any thoughts on that? I mean, I know one way that I've gotten at least the first part of the video to work.
It kind of all depends on what the archiver was. I can't actually tell if this was RAR or not.
Yeah.
But if your archiver allows you to, say, begin at a partial file, so begin at part 5, skipping the broken one, and assuming that it is, like, MPEG, right, you could run it through something like Video Redo and reset the key file or the keyframe sequence to say, give it a proper MPEG header and redo the sequence. Because it's like the file, certain programs, like, they're going to know what the file is based on the different key segments in the file. And you can just produce a new header and say, just say as if you've cropped the movie at a particular point and give the important information up ahead and then just resequence the file.
Yeah, and
would
I
be
would,
one method.
I would have been fine, too, if I could just extract it, but then I have one corrupt part on the video, because at least then I have, you know, most of the video, and I could do that. Now, I've had a couple of times where I had RAR ends up getting to a corrupt part, and it won't go any further. And what I've done in the past is I pause it right before I know it's about to stop, and then I go to the directory, and I copy-paste the file, and then I at least get up to that point.
Right.
And it makes a new copy of the file, because if you cancel it, then it just deletes what it just did. But I don't know of a way to, like, still give me the extracted file, but allow some corruption in whatever part that you don't have. I don't know of a way to do that, so I'm hoping, like, we crowdsource this. Maybe someone's done that before and has a way around that.
I'd be willing to bet that, again, depending on the archiver, there is some method to continue on, because you would have to debug corrupted archives. So you'd want to be able to see what it was corrupted.
Yeah.
But, again, I don't know the intricacies, the internals of WinRAR, let alone whatever archiver was being used here.
Yeah.
But there are definitely archivers that will let you override stopping of the processing and let you continue on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, assuming that you can find an option to do that, then that would be a method.
Yeah, and for anyone who's going to send someone a really big file and is trying to split it up, one piece of advice that I would give is try to split up the original video rather than putting it into a RAR file, because video is compressed anyway, and usually the amount of benefit you get from archiving it with, like, WinRAR or something like that isn't that much. So,
and you're actually just adding overhead.
Too. Yeah.
Actually, if you're saving anything at all, imagine if you're compressing in H.264, you know, you're actually not going to be saving anything, and you might be adding overhead with the compression algorithm.
Yeah, so use a H-split or whatever the application is that'll split a file, and you can split a video. You can always put that video back together, and it's going to work. And then if one part is corrupt, you at least have the entire rest of the video that you can start from. So yeah, let me know if you've ever experienced that and what your fix was. Next question. I'm trying to run automatically and silently install a specific print driver and printer to prepare multiple machines for run tests. I use the command line install of print driver, and they give that here, ghostscript pdf, /kh x64. The ctemp lib has driver copied for ghost pdf. The install shows a message, window can't verify the publisher of this driver software. There's multiple solutions to suppress this warning. All involves a reboot. Is there a way to suppress the window security warning and install the print driver using scripts?
Yeah, the absolute best way, sign the driver yourself.
Yeah.
If you actually trust it, you don't want to see the message, sign it yourself and carry on its way. You don't want to disable the message itself.
Yeah.
Because once you disable the message, you disable it completely. So
yeah.
Don't bother doing it.
There might be other things down the road that aren't
exactly
you know and say.
Right. So just sign it yourself. We definitely want to get the word out there. Make sure that you're installing, you know, files that you know are trusted. Sign the files if you own them and are, you know, sending them out. It's really cheap nowadays. I can see in the future, like, everybody is really going to want to be ensuring the integrity of their files, and it's just overall better. You can self-sign things yourself if you don't need to distribute it, and for testing purposes.
So in this case, it's like if you want someone to be able to get into your house, you make them a key. You don't knock a hole in the house so everyone can get in. So.
Exactly.
All right. Next question. It says, when I right-click on in a window showing my C directory in Windows 7, try to create a new text file, I get the error message, a required privilege is not held by the client. Why is this, and how can I change it?
It's by design. Win 7 with UAC on, standard users don't have the capability of writing files to the root of the drive. You can create a directory at the root of the drive and then create files there, but you can't create files at the root of the drive.
Okay. All right.
So if you want to do that, elevate a command prompt and do what you need to do there.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So now we're up to pick of the week. Pick of the week. And so today I want to talk about my Stirling engine. It's been
your
sitting
toy.
There spinning. Yeah, my new toy. And so the idea behind this is it's a Stirling engine, and it runs off a temperature differential. So if you have greater than 10 degrees temperature between the top plate and the bottom plate, then this little baby will spin around. and it's kind of cool. I use it at home. You can set it on top of your router or on top of any other equipment you have that, you know, might be hot, and you can tell by how fast it's spinning, you know, how hot that device is. And you can see that I'm running it here. I've got it up on a couple of Altoids boxes, and the exhaust for my laptop.
You can use for anything.
I know. It's like, I've got a whole box of empty Altoids boxes at home that I use for all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you just angle it, and I've got the exhaust pointing out through the bottom of it, and then I just started rendering a video on there to get it to spin. And so, yeah.
You realize how inefficient and how ecologically unfriendly just this particular setup is.
Yeah, I know.
The engine itself, for using it for the purpose of simply detecting whether or not something is getting hot or cold or whatever, it's actually brilliant.
Yeah.
But just this particular demonstration for it is awful.
It's for the camera. It's for the folks at home. So, yeah, I know, though. But typically, when I'm sitting at my desk at work, I am rendering a video, and I do have all this heat coming out of there. And so I was like, yeah, I wish I could do something other than warm my hands in the winter with this. So, yeah, I got this. It costs about, you know, the cost of an Xbox game or something here, and I'll link to a couple different places that you can get them. The one thing is, I wish it was a kit, because I would have liked to have built it myself. But it came already put together. The only thing you had to do is just put the flywheel on it, and it sits there and spins around. It's just kind of cool. It's kind of almost a steampunkish looking.
Yeah, it is. I like that. Here's a link to the physics behind it and how a Stirling engine works. You know, it's relatively simple.
Yeah, it was good for my kids. I got to sit and talk to them about it. They were really interested, and they're like, there's nothing, no moving parts in there. How does it work? And so we get a physics lesson and get to talk about all the different aspects of how this works. And, you know, why can't the world be powered off this? Well, they're not that good. But
geothermal.
Yeah, there is that. That's a much bigger temperature differential there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read somewhere that Dean Kamen originally wanted the Segway to run off the Stirling engine, but he couldn't perfect it, so it ended up being battery-powered. But, you know, so there you have it. That's the Stirling engine, and I'll link to it if you want to get one for yourself. And
I really want to mill one.
Yeah, I know. We were talking earlier, and he's like, you know, if I had a little metal lathe, I could. And I was like, oh, yeah. That's what you need. You need a metal lathe in your house.
I desperately need a metal lathe.
Too.
I need a metal lathe and a forge.
You need a workshop.
I need a nice big one.
You should. Have you seen Clint's office, Clint Ruckus?
No.
You should walk past his office. It's like a little mini MSR laboratory going on in his office. So
that'd be a kid in a candy store.
Yeah. All right, so that's the show for this week. If you want to email us, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com. You can leave a message in the comments on the show notes, but we prefer an email so we can go back and forth with you. See you next week.